Well, Private Passions and Michael Barclay will be with you in just a moment, right after this.
Sound speed, set, action.
The debut novel from Tom Hanks on BBC Sounds.
We are rolling. At least a dozen people yelled, rolling!
A story inspired by the magic of movie making.
Bob Falls trooped down the gangway with a few hundred other Marines. He spent the most time going over the panels of Heroes Under Fire.
Written and read by Tom Hanks.
The first day of shooting started off with a sense an event was about to happen.
The making of another major motion picture masterpiece.
And cut.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest is the novelist Kit Duval.
Kit Duval published her first novel in 2016 and enjoyed the kind of success every debut author must dream of. My Name is Leon, the story of a 9-year-old boy growing up in foster care, won critical acclaim and prizes, became an international bestseller, and was filmed for BBC television. This literary achievement would definitely have surprised the younger Kit, who hated reading as a child and only took up writing as a career in her 40s. Until then, she had worked in the legal system, including many years as a magistrate and an advisor on foster care and adoption. Her unusual route to a literary career has made her very keen to help other aspiring writers, and she launched and funds a creative writing scholarship for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. I think, Kit, music came into your life quite often through a visual medium, film.
It did, absolutely. My father was obsessed with film. He's a very uneducated man, but he knew all there was to know about film. He would not just know the film, he would know the director, he would point out the lighting. He would ask us, you know, Clark Gable, who was he married to? And we had to know. So we had this sort of PhD, courtesy of my father, and we had soundtrack, and we had that introduction to music and to classical music.
This first one that you've chosen is from Brief Encounter, isn't it?
I called it the theme music. In fact, I still call it the theme music to Brief Encounter. I would have watched Brief Encounter maybe 3 or 4 times in my childhood, and very, very moved by this beautiful music. I prefer it to have my eyes closed and hum along and feel the passion that's in the music.
Thank you.
thing you do get from learning classical music through film is that you learn that classical music has a narrative. I didn't know that before. I'd never have imagined it because there's no words and because it's not the traditional form of music that I'd understood. But having an introduction to classical music through film or through something visual, you learn that they're doing something, moving you in this way, making you feel that, and then this, and then anger and excitement. I think that's wonderful.
We heard the beginning of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2, played by Yevgeny Kissin with the London Symphony Orchestra. Kit Duval, as eagle-eared listeners may have noticed, you grew up in Birmingham.
Yes.
In the 1960s and 70s. And I think there was only one book, really, in the house.
Oh, yes, the Bible. Yes, that's it. Nothing else, no other reading material.
Your memoir, Without Warning and Only Sometimes, carries the subtitle Scenes from an Unpredictable Childhood. And part of this unpredictability came from your mum's religious beliefs. Your childhood was pretty different from those of your school friends.
Yes, my mother, who was raised an Irish Catholic, became a Jehovah's Witness. And that meant that we had to be Jehovah's Witnesses and we had to go to meetings three times a week. We had to read the Bible. We had to knock on people's doors to try and convert them. And we had the usual Jehovah's Witness prohibitions on having any fun, like birthdays, Christmas, or any enjoyment whatsoever. It's a pretty joyless religion all in all.
Do you think that possibly this somewhat colourless, aesthetically speaking, childhood meant that you lived a kind of existential existence in your mind and created images for yourself which perhaps helped you to become a writer later?
Yes, definitely. I was very aware that I wanted to escape reality. I was regularly in trouble at school for not paying attention. But I do think it helps you, as a writer, it helps you imagine other people's feelings because you spend so long with the what if and I wonder and what's that like. And that definitely was most of my childhood.
Well, your next music comes from another film, Carmen Jones. This is Bizet's opera, reworked by Oscar Hammerstein. Now, why did this have such an impact on you?
Well, this was a huge thing in our family because Carmen Jones was the only film where everybody was black. And by everybody, everybody, the woman walking past with the pram, the man crossing the road, the taxi driver, we knew what parts black people normally played in film. The maid, the butler, the piano player, the slave, the runaway. Here was a film where there were black people, the star, not just the star, the secondary, the female lead, the male lead, everybody, fantastic actors, Harry Belafonte, Dorothy Dandridge, Dinah Carroll was in it. It was the first time we had seen black people up there on the screen with no apology, owning the film. And it's been much maligned, actually. People talk about cultural appropriation because it was Otto Preminger, a Jewish director who took the film and made it what it was. I disagree with that because for a young girl in the 60s, a black girl in a white world, to see black people on the screen being exciting and bold and brassy and being the lead. It was fantastic. It opened the door for black actors, even though Harry Belafonte and Dorothy Dandridge, the two leads, were dubbed. Why, I don't know, because they can both sing.
Well, she was dubbed, as you say, by Marilyn Horne, and that's who we're going to hear in Dat's Love from Carmen
yes.
Jones.
I won't pick out a man and he won't pick out me. It don't go that way. You can't ever know where your crazy heart wants to go. Love's a baby that grows up wild and he don't do what you want him to. Love ain't nobody's angel child, and he won't pay any mind to you. One man gives me his diamond stud, and I won't give him a cigarette. One man treats me like I was mud, and all I got that man can get. But if your heart to get a go for you, and if I do, then you are through, boy. My baby, that's the end of you.
End of you.
So take your cue, boy. Don't say I didn't tell you true.
She told you true.
I told you truly. If I love you, that's the end of you.
Home for me and I'm taboo. But if your heart to give, I go for you. And if I do, then you are through. For my baby, that's the end of you. The end of you.
So take your cue, boy. Don't say I didn't tell you true.
Told you so.
I told you truly. If I love you, that's the end. To fly, there ain't no door that you can close. She just picks you a quick goodbye and flicks the salt from a tail and goes. If you listen, then you'll get taught, and here's your lesson for today. If I chase you, then you'll get caught, and once I got you, I go my way.
When your lover decides,
that's love. Go for me and I'm taboo. But if you're hard to get, I go for you. And if I do, then you are through, boy. My baby, that's the end of you.
The end of you.
So take your cue, boy. Don't say I didn't tell you true.
She told you true.
I told you truly. If I
That's Love from Carmen Jones. Bizet's opera, Carmen, reworked for Broadway in the 1940s by Oscar Hammerstein. And we heard a track from the soundtrack of the 1954 film version, which is the one, Kit Duvall, that you would have known, in which Dorothy Dandridge plays Carmen Jones, though she is dubbed for the songs by the mezzo-soprano Marilyn Horne, who we heard there. You know, one of the great tragedies I think about whenever I think of Carmen is the fact that Bizet died before he knew it was a success.
Oh, I
can you imagine
know.
That?
I didn't know that. It must have been tragic to not know that that was going to be so popular.
Now, you owe a lot of these interests to your dad, as you say. He was a bus driver, wasn't he?
Yes.
Born in St. Kitts in the Caribbean. How do you picture him now?
He would have loved to see my success. He wouldn't have believed it was possible because I never read anything and left school. I wasn't even 16 when I left school. So he would have been immensely proud and like Bizet.
Yes.
Never got to see his baby. Absolutely.
Yeah. Did he dream of going back to St. Kitts?
Oh, he dreamt. He called St. Kitts home. He would never have called Birmingham or England home. St. Kitts was home. And he dreamt about going back. He only came to England for a few years to make some money and to go back and to have a life there. And of course, he met an Irish Catholic who didn't believe in birth control. So 5 children later, he found himself still in England where he died. And he would have not wanted to have died in England.
Did schools build at all on what you were learning about music from films? I mean, did you get exposed to any kind of music?
I went to a very, very good grammar school, and we had a music teacher who Irish people would have called had notions, meaning he was reaching perhaps above his pay grade, and he wrote little operettas. He wrote one called Robin Hood. He was so enthusiastic. He was quite mad. He had red, spiky hair. And he exposed us to classical music. We sang the Mikado at school. I sang alto in Handel's Messiah for a Christmas concert.
Now, the next piece of music is not choral, but perhaps you came to it through your love of breath control, because very unusual, we have here someone playing a Bach partita on the flute.
Yes, I found this piece of music and I quite liked it. But then I heard the breath of the player. And in this world of AI and drum machines and music machines, it was so visceral and beautiful to hear and then carry on. I was immediately captivated. You can almost hear her lips on metal, on wood, the wind. It's much more than a tune. It's a connection, I think, to the person.
And it's often thought that these Bach unaccompanied partitas sort of get to the naked human soul, because there's no accompaniment.
Yes, and there's nowhere to hide. It's just that pure sound. To me, it definitely has a narrative. It's this skippy, jumpy. Whenever I think of it, I think of an excited child speaking to its mother and the mother answering, and then it comes to this end bit where a child might say, "And then I did this." It's joyous. It's a beautiful piece of music.
Thank you. What a tour de force.
Oh, that's so great. It's beautiful.
We heard the flautist Marion Rolancourt performing the Allemande from Bach's Partita in A minor, originally written for solo violin. Your mum was Irish, and Kit Duval, growing up in Birmingham in the 60s and 70s, you must have been somewhat caught between the three worlds of the British, the Caribbean and the Irish.
Absolutely. We were brought up in mostly the Irish part of Birmingham. My grandmother came from Wexford sometime in the 30s and lived in Sparkbrook in a big boarding house and took in lodgers, Irish lodgers. And my father, of course, was a member of the black community, the Caribbean community. He was a bus driver. Lots of bus drivers were from the Caribbean. And then, of course, we were Brummies. We were Birmingham children. And we learnt really early on this code switching that goes on when you come from different communities. So I would speak to my grandmother with a certain vocabulary and a certain music to my language, and I knew what I could talk about and what I couldn't. And then we had at home a black grandmother who lived with us. We called her Black Nana. And I had a different language for her, same meaning, different vocabulary, different diction, different music. And then I had my own voice for my friends and for school. You don't know you're doing it when you're a child. You just do this inflection to be understood.
Do you think this is what led you to write so wonderfully about children and the way they think?
Yes. I mean, it helps to be immature, and I'm quite immature. but yes, I do remember having to learn pretty quickly and pretty invisibly that this was how you interpreted the adult world.
You must remember also, I suspect, 1974, when 21 people were killed in and 182 injured in the Birmingham pub bombings, attributed to the IRA. Do you recall that?
Very well. I was 14, and the day after the pub bombings, the bus was rerouted around the city centre, so I was late for school. I expected to get told off. But, of course, the whole school was in uproar. There was a special assembly, and there was a great deal of anxiety. People spoke very badly about Irish people, the way people speak about Muslims. It's almost synonymous with terrorism. So Irish were terrorists. Fortunately, at school, no one looks at me. I've got brown skin. No one looks at me and thinks I'm Irish. So I was hearing what people thought about Irish people, and it was horrible. And it took a while for the Birmingham Irish to be trusted again, really.
Now, you were introduced to our next music by your Irish grandfather, weren't you?
Yes, my grandfather was a musician. He played the fiddle and he played the accordion, and we would go to visit on a Sunday. And my mother would disappear with my grandmother and they'd go to gossip in the kitchen. And we would be with my grandfather, who would get the squeeze box out, as we called it. And it had that breathy quality, and he would weave his hands, and he had labourer's hands. He was a labourer, and his hands would dance over the black keys while he did this sort of sewing breath motion and sing traditional Irish songs, most of which we knew and we would sing along with him.
And which one have you chosen?
I've chosen, and I don't know how to say it in Irish, which is to my shame, but it's called The Twisting of the Rope, or Frankie's Song.
Dal caso calinda sa ramen oignis na dra luib na quille glisce uir of yogriv la shen ragur hog shi duum kakyun augus gutla Tan sail na gull is bogle me shun su shin bon. Sma vien to luom bi luom a storin mokri. Sma vien to luom bi luom a skovu horti. Ma vien to luom skor luom chor loch dat chri. Shem a vile knock nach a loom de taunik tu marvni. Da viso hal im buach a letrum var gri. Stavies a hell agus dimmer ovin cart limni. Davies a hell agus dimmer ovin cuig le nu a hri. Congar yinnan van sa laung o lung o gom hri. Sma havien to luam bi luam a storin mchri. Sma havien to luam bi luam o sko horti. Ma havien to luam sko luam ga chor lochtet chri. Shem a vile knock nach a loom de daunig to marvni.
The Irish folk song, The Twisting of the Rope, or Frankie's Song, sung by Eola O'Linnard, on the soundtrack of the 2015 film Brooklyn. You're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3 and BBC Sounds with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today, the writer Kit Duval. And we've heard about your parents. We haven't heard much about your brother and three sisters. Were you close?
Very close. Still are very close. We were very different to our parents. We were a tribe of five, and we survived our difficult childhood because of one another, because we got one another through it. We forged this little group of fairly naughty children, and we always made sure each of us were okay.
So they were an influence on you as much as your parents in some ways?
Oh, definitely, except they're all quite bohemian and arty and different and weird and very much, you know, marched their own drum, much more so than I did. I was much more withdrawn. I was a watcher. They were doers. They would go out and do things and experience things. And I'd quite like second as a place. I quite like to be just behind.
But you were watching and observing and storing up for things that later came out in
yes.
your writing.
Yes.
The next piece is Miles Davis, and this is always an immediately recognisable sound, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, I didn't know anything about it. My younger sister, Karen, had been speaking to me about jazz, and I was like, I could not be less interested in jazz. And I went to visit her one day and just walked in. And as I walked in, she put this track on a turntable and then disappeared. I didn't even see her. I walk into this room filled with Miles Davis. I don't know, it's Miles Davis. And I looked at the turntable and the record was going around, this black record, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was so empty and beautiful. And I stood in her sitting room with my bag on my shoulder, looking at the turntable until it finished. And she came in the room and she said, "See?" And she knew, she could tell from my face that I was like, oh my God, what was that? What was beautiful about it is there's a principle in writing where you leave space for the reader. If you describe something, you don't describe all of it. You choose something and you just say that one thing and leave the reader to do the work. And I felt that's what was going on here. In the spaces, there was room for me to hear what wasn't said, hear the narrative. And it's still one of those pieces I cannot listen to if there's anything else going on.
So both she and Miles did a number on you, really.
They
and
really
the number
did.
Was blue and green.
Absolutely. Sometimes I go for a drive on a dark motorway in the rain and listen to that. And it's somebody with you. There's someone with you at the time.
Blue in Green by Miles Davis and Bill Evans, performed by the Miles Davis Sextet on Davis's 1959 album, Kind of Blue. When you left school at 16, what were your ambitions then?
Not to die. I believed Jehovah's Witnesses. I'd been taught since I was a little girl that I was going to die in 1976 when the world ended. Anyone that was bad or naughty was going to die, and I definitely thought I was bad and naughty. So I thought when I was 16 that I wanted to stay alive. And if I was going to stay alive, I wanted to taste the forbidden fruit and all the things that I was going to die for. So I was pretty wild, but I had absolutely no plans whatsoever, because I thought that if it didn't, the end hadn't come in 1976, therefore it'd be 1977. And when 1977 came, well, it was just late and it would be 1978. And I went on like that until I was in my 20s.
And how did you come to get a job in the legal system?
I was taking a lot of drugs at the time. Just before the time. And had had quite a bad time. I'd had a few bad trips. I felt very mentally unstable and just wanted to get a job for something to do. And I would have done any job. It just so happened that I was offered a job with the CPS. And it was utterly fascinating. I was learning about crime and evidence, and I was reading pathologist reports and firearms experts. From there, I went to work for social services, training foster carers and social workers in the care of children that were looked after, children in the care system.
Presumably your experiences did make you understand a bit of the problems people were getting into.
Oh, yes, yes. And a lot of the clients that I had when I was working in defence law and in foster care, these are people who have not had good examples or life chances or the circumstances to succeed. Nobody goes out to have their children taken into care or to go to prison. Circumstances happen, bad decisions, and I believe we're all one bad decision away from something disastrous happening. And indeed, I'm just very lucky there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Because it's a means of escape, essentially, from bad situations, drugs, isn't
it? It is.
And that's why it's so pernicious.
It's so pernicious. And that and my strange upbringing led to mental health problems.
Well, a much safer form of escape comes through the music of Vivaldi, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, indeed. This next track, which I only recently discovered, it's sort of disjointed and a bit messy. Every time it comes on, I feel lighter. It's got this bouncy life in it. It's full of life.
Oh, how can infinite just
Ah, ch'infelice sempre, o forever unhappy, from Vivaldi's cantata Cesate amai cesare. Cease, now cease, performed by the countertenor Andreas Scholl with the ensemble 415. In your memoir, Kitaval, you say that reading saved your life.
Yes.
I start to think I might not die. I might find a way to live through books and other people's lives.
Yes.
So what made the leap from reading to writing for you?
Boredom, mostly. I didn't plan to be a writer. I adopted a little boy who was ill, had to give up work for the first time in 20 years or so. And I had read hundreds of books by then, so I thought, oh, you know, I'll write a book. How hard can it be? I didn't really take it seriously. I thought it'd be very easy, and I'd just knock one out and send it to Penguin. They'd put a wrapper on it, and it'd be in Waterstones in, let's say, 6 weeks. I had no idea how difficult it was going to be, how bad I would be to begin with. Unfortunately, or fortunately, once I had written something bad, I knew that was it. This is the thing that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so then became the agonies of trying to get better.
So your first novel, My Name is Leon, was not the first effort to write something?
No, not at all. My first effort was actually a screenplay that wasn't very good. And I turned that into a novel that in turn wasn't very good. It was because I was writing something that I didn't believe in. It wasn't coming from the belly, it wasn't coming from the heart. Probably it was the beginning of being humble as well. I thought I could knock these books out, and actually I had to care. And I cared about Leon, desperately cared, and desperately wanted to get it right.
Well, it was set in 1980s Birmingham, and it's the story of a 9-year-old mixed-race boy in the care system, which, of course, you know very well. Were you very surprised that...
I was amazed. I was amazed. I'd had these two books rejected out of hand, quite brutally. So when I wrote Leon, I thought, well, my sisters will read it, my mum will read it, my friends will read it, a couple of social workers will read it. And if I have a readership of, let's say, 300, I would have been very, very happy. So when it became a big book, it's now on the GCSE curriculum, I continue to be amazed that this simple story about one summer in a boy's life can touch so many people.
Do you find that music is part of your writing process?
Oh, absolutely. Every book I've ever written has a playlist on my computer to access the emotion I need. And I'll go, there it is. There's the note that I'm trying to hit. That's what I'm trying to say to people. Then I'll turn it off and write.
That's fascinating, because people sometimes say to me as a composer, how do you start a piece? And I'll say, rather as you've just done, there's an atmosphere that I want to conjure up, and it completely colours the first few notes.
Yes, yes. And for me, it colours the end. I want...
Yes, the end's very important.
Yes, I want people to go, oh, at a certain place. I want them to feel this at the end. And so I compile this playlist that has, to me, that note over and over and over, and I go, that's it, that's the register.
Well, this next piece you've chosen, because it does indeed convey a very specific emotion.
Oh, it's devastating. It's one of those pieces of music where if you think to yourself, I need a good cry, put this on. It's the most simple, most devastating piece of music I've ever heard. Thank you.
So the sensibility that you are wading in and through when you play that music is what?
I nearly had it, and it's gone. That's, to me, that's what I hear in that. I nearly had it. I had my hands on it, and now it's gone. It's regret, and at the end, resignation.
Chopin's Prelude in E minor, Opus 28, number 4, performed by Maria João Pires. We were talking about how important the sensibility of beginnings and endings are, and sadly we've come to our final choice, and it's from an opera, a wonderful opera, full of marvellous melodies, Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Again, a story about black people written by a white man. So it's had a controversial history.
Yes.
But your take on it is?
My take on it is that the sentiment of this song and of the opera itself is one of truth. It's about drug dealing, it's about gambling, it's about prostitution. And the criticisms of it have been that here is another story where black people are living those kinds of lives instead of a celebratory story about success. But for me, it was the reality of many lives at the time. This speaks to many, many black people.
And you've gone one further than just the opera, because you've got Nina Simone,
yes,
singing I Loves You, Porgy.
Yes, and she has taken that song and she's put her own agonies into it. You can hear her agonies in the song. She's not singing it. She's living right from beginning to end.
Well, that's a nice note, if a somewhat sad note, for me to say thank you very much, Kit Duval, for your Private Passions.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay here with you forever. And I'll be so glad. Someday I know he's coming back to call on me. He's going to handle me and hold me so. It's gonna be like dying, Porgy, daddy deep inside me. But when he comes, I know I'll have to go.
Nina Simone's version of I Loves You, Porgy from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, the final choice of today's Private Passions guest, Kit Duval. The programme was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Graham Rogers. And for details of all the music played and to discover many previous editions with writers including Sarah Perry, Michael Frayn, Deborah Levy and Andrew O'Hagan, head to BBC Sounds and search for Private Passions. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news read by me, Jane Royce.
The Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick, says the UK has to reduce its reliance on hotels for housing migrants and asylum seekers. He said it was fair and reasonable for adult males to share rooms to cut costs. Last week, a group of asylum seekers refused to enter a hotel in London in which they said they'd been asked to sleep four people to a room. India's railway minister says an issue with the electronic safety system which regulates signals was the probable cause of the deadly rail crash in Odisha state on Friday. Officials now say 275 people died. The rescue operation is over and efforts are being made to clear away the twisted wreckage and overturned carriages so train traffic can restart. The Cabinet Office has warned Boris Johnson he could lose public funding for his legal team at the COVID inquiry if he deliberately undermines the government. In a letter published by the Sunday Times, Mr. Johnson is told he'll have to submit any witness statements to Cabinet Office officials first. The government insists the letter to Mr. Johnson was intended to protect public funds, so lawyers paid for by the public aren't used for any other purpose than aiding the inquiry. The General Secretary of the GMB Union, Gary Smith, has criticised Labour for what he called its naive plans to stop issuing new licences for oil and gas production in the North Sea. Mr. Smith said the UK faced the choice between producing its own oil and gas or importing more. Labour says existing fields in the North Sea could continue production while it invested in renewables. The new head of the CBI, Rayne Newton-Smith, has insisted the business lobby group does have a future. A crucial vote on her plans to restore trust in it takes place next week. She said she'd set out a programme of change to show they had the right culture and were supporting people who raised issues. King Charles is giving up the lease on his Welsh estate. The Llanywermod estate in Carmarthenshire, which includes a three-bedroom property set in the grounds of a ruined mansion, is owned by the Duchy of Cornwall, which has now passed to Prince William. And the weather will be dry, warm and sunny for many this afternoon. Northwestern parts of the UK will have some patchy cloud and the odd light shower. And that's the BBC News. It's 2 minutes past one.
There's always more to discover on BBC Radio 3. J to Z, your gateway to new jazz sounds.
Lots of rhythms and lots of vibes.
This is an utterly sublime album. Every time I hear this track, I can't sit still.
It just brings this real sense of life and living in the way a performer performs.
The very best of jazz, past, present and future. J to Z.